stripper, while spewing about how what was happening wasn't just about the living versus the dead. It would send shockwaves through every facet of our society. Social, economic, political, even environmental. He said that, subconsciously, everyone already knew the truth during the Great Denial, and that's why they wigged out so hard when the story was finally broken. It all actually kind of made sense, until he started spewing about high fructose corn syrup and the feminization of America. Crazy, I know, but you kind of expected those people to be there. At least I did. What I didn't expect was all their people. Every one of them, no matter who they were or what they did, had to have at least I don't know how many stylists and publicists and personal assistants. Some of them, I think, were pretty cool, just doing it for the money, or because they figured they'd be safe there. Young people just trying to get a leg up. I can't fault them for that. Some of the others, though, real pricks, all drunk on the smell of their own shit. Just rude and pushy and ordering everyone else around. One guy sticks out in my mind, only because he wore this baseball cap that read, "Get it done." I think he was the chief handler of the fat fuck who won that talent show. That guy must have had 14 people around him. I remember thinking at first that it would be impossible to take care of all these people. But then after my initial tour of the premises, I realized our boss had planned for everything. He transformed his home into a survivalist's wet dream. He had enough dehydrated food to keep an army fed for years, as well as an endless supply of water from a desalinizer that ran right out into the ocean. He had wind turbines, solar panels, and backup generators with giant fuel tanks buried right under the courtyard. He had enough security measures to hold off the living dead forever. High walls, motion sensors, and weapons. Oh, the weapons. Yeah. Our boss had really done his homework. But what he was most proud of was the fact that every room in the house was wired for a simultaneous webcast that went out all over the world 24/7. This was the real reason for having all his closest and best friends over. He didn't just want to ride out the storm in comfort and luxury. He wanted everyone to know he'd done it. That was the celebrity angle, his way of ensuring high-profile exposure. Not only did you have a webcam in almost every room, but there was all the usual press you'd find on the Oscars red carpet. I honestly never knew how big an industry entertainment journalism was. There had to be dozens of them there from all these magazines and TV shows. "How are you feeling?" I heard that a lot. "How are you holding up? What do you think is going to happen?" And I swear, I even heard someone ask, "What are you wearing?" For me, the most surreal moment was standing in the kitchen with some of the staff and other bodyguards, all of us watching the news that was showing, guess what? Us. The cameras were literally in the other room, pointed at some of the stars as they sat on the couch watching another news channel. The feed was live from New York's Upper East Side. They were coming right up Third Avenue. People were taking them on, hand to hand, hammers and pipes. The manager of a Modell Sporting Goods was handing out all his baseball bats and shouting, "Get him in the head!" There was this one guy on rollerblades. He had a hockey stick in his hand, a big old meat cleaver bolted to the blade. He was doing an easy 30. At that speed, he might have taken a neck or two. The camera saw the whole thing. The rotted arm that shot out of the sewer drain in front of him. The poor guy backflipping into the air, coming down hard on his face, then being dragged screaming by his ponytail into the drain. At that moment, the camera in our living room swung back to catch the reactions of the watching celebs. There were a few gasps, some honest, some staged. I remember thinking I had less respect for the ones who tried to fake some tears than I did for the little spoiled whore who called the rollerblading guy a dumbass. Hey, at least she was being honest. I remember standing next to this guy, Sergey, miserable, sad face, hulking motherfucker. His stories about growing up in Russia convinced me that not all third-world cesspools had to be tropical. It was when the camera was catching the reactions of the beautiful people that he mumbled something to himself in Russian. The only word I could make out was Romanovs, and I was about to ask him what he meant when we all heard the alarm go off. Something had triggered the pressure sensors we'd placed several miles around the wall. They were sensitive enough to detect just one zombie. Now they were going crazy. Our radios were squawking. "Contact! Contact! Southwest corner! Shit, there's hundreds of them!" It was a damn big house. It took me a long time to get to my firing position. I didn't understand why the lookout was so nervous. So what if there's a couple hundred? They'd never get over the wall. Shit. We might as well just kick back and enjoy the party. Then I heard him shout, "They're running! Holy fucking shit, they're fast!" Fast zombies. That turned my gut. If they could run, they could climb. If they could climb, maybe they could think. And if they could think... Now I was scared. I remember our boss's friends were all raiding the armory, racing around like extras in an 80s action flick by the time I made the third floor guest room window. I flipped the safety off my weapon and flipped the guards off my sight. It was one of the newest gens, a fusion of light amplification and thermal imaging. I didn't need the second part, because G's gave off no body heat. So when I saw the searing bright green signatures of several hundred runners, my throat tightened. Those weren't living dead. "There it is," I heard them shout. "That's the house on the news." They were carrying ladders, guns, babies. A couple of them had these heavy satchels strapped to their backs. They were all booking it for the front gate. Big, tough steel that was supposed to stop 1,000 ghouls. The explosion tore them right off their hinges, sent them flipping into the house like giant ninja stars. "Fire!" the boss was screaming into the radio. "Knock 'em down! Kill 'em! Shoot, shoot, shoot!" The attackers, for lack of a better label, stampeded for the house. The courtyard was full of parked vehicles, sports cars and Hummers, and even a monster truck belonging to some NFL cat. Freaking fireballs, all of them, blowing over on their sides or just burning in place. This thick, oily smoke from their tires blinding and choking everyone. All you could hear was gunfire, ours and theirs. And not just our private security team. Any big shot who wasn't crapping their pants either had it in his head to be a hero or felt he had to protect his rep in front of his peeps. A lot of them demanded that their entourage protect them. Some did. These poor 20-year-old personal assistants who'd never fired a gun in their lives. They didn't last very long. But then there were also the peons who turned and joined the attackers. I saw this one real queenie hairdresser stab an actress in the mouth with a letter opener, and, ironically, I watched Mr. Get It Done try to wrestle a grenade away from the talent show guy before it went off in their hands. It was bedlam, exactly what you thought the end of the world was supposed to look like. Part of the house was burning, blood everywhere, bodies, or bits of them, spewed all over that expensive stuff. I met the whore's rat dog as we were both heading for the back door. He looked at me, I looked at him. If it had been a conversation, it probably would have gone like, "What about your master? What about yours? Fuck 'em." That was the attitude among a lot of the hired guns, the reason I hadn't fired a shot all night. We'd been paid to protect rich people from zombies, not against other not-so-rich people who just wanted a safe place to hide. You could hear them shouting as they charged in through the front door. Not, "Grab the booze," or "Rape the bitches." It was, "Put out the fire, and get the women and kids upstairs." I stepped over Mr. Political Comedy Guy on my way out to the beach. He and this chick, this leathery old blonde who I thought was supposed to be his political enemy, were going at it like there was no tomorrow. And hey, maybe for them, there wasn't. I made it out to the sand, found a surfboard, probably worth more than the house I grew up in, and started paddling for the lights on the horizon. There were a lot of boats on the water that night, a lot of people getting out of Dodge. I hoped one of them might give me a ride as far as New York Harbor. Hopefully, I could bribe them with a pair of diamond earrings.
He finishes his shot of rum and signals for another.
Sometimes I ask myself, why didn't they all just shut the fuck up, you know? Not just my boss, but all those pampered parasites. They had the means to stay out of harm's way, so why didn't they use it? Go to Antarctica or Greenland, or just stay where they were, but stay the hell out of the public eye. But then again, maybe they couldn't. Like a switch you just can't turn off. Maybe it's what made them who they were in the first place. But what the hell do I know?
The waiter arrives with another shot, and Tishon flicks a silver rand coin to him.
If you got it, flaunt it.
Ice City, Greenland. From the surface, all that is visible are the funnels, the massive, carefully sculpted wind catchers that continue to bring fresh, albeit cold, air to the 300-kilometer maze below. Few of the 250,000 people who once inhabited this hand-carved marvel of engineering have remained. Some stay to encourage the small but growing tourist trade. Some are here as custodians, living on the pension that goes with UNESCO's renewed World Heritage Program. Some, like Ahmed Farhanakian, formerly Major Farhanakian, of the Iranian Revolution Guards Corps Air Force, have nowhere else to go.
India and Pakistan, like North and South Korea or NATO and the old Warsaw Pact. If two sides were going to use nuclear weapons against each other, it had to be India and Pakistan. Everyone knew it. Everyone expected it, and that is exactly why it didn't happen. Because the danger was so omnipresent. All the machinery had been put in place over the years to avoid it. The hotline between the two capitals was in place. Ambassadors were on a first-name basis, and generals, politicians, and everyone involved in the process was trained to make sure the day they all feared never came. No one could have imagined, I certainly didn't, that events would unfold as they did. The infection hadn't hit us as hard as some other countries. Our land was very mountainous. Transportation was difficult. Our population was relatively small. Given the size of our country, and when you consider that many of our cities could be easily isolated by a proportionately large military, it is not difficult to see how optimistic our leadership was. The problem was refugees. Millions of them from the east. Millions. Streaming across Balochistan, throwing our plans into disarray. So many areas were already infected, great swarms slouching toward our cities. Our border guards were overwhelmed, entire outposts buried under waves of ghouls. There was no way to close the border and at the same time deal with our own outbreaks. We demanded that the Pakistanis get control of their people. They assured us they were doing all they could. We knew they were lying. The majority of refugees came from India, just passing through Pakistan in an attempt to reach someplace safe. Those in Islamabad were quite willing to let them go. Better to pass the problem along to another nation than to have to deal with it themselves. Perhaps if we could have combined our forces, coordinated a joint operation at some appropriately defensible location. I know the plans were on the table. Pakistan's south central mountains, the Pab, the Kirtar, the central Brahui range. We could have stopped any number of refugees, or living dead. Our plan was refused. Some paranoid military attaché at their embassy told us outright that any foreign troops on their soil would be seen as a declaration of war. I don't know if their president ever saw our proposal. Our leaders never spoke to him directly. You see what I mean about India and Pakistan? We didn't have their relationship. The diplomatic machinery was not in place. For all we know, this little shit-eating colonel informed his government that we were attempting to annex their western provinces. But what could we do? Every day, hundreds of thousands of people crossed our border. And of those, perhaps tens of thousands were infected. We had to take decisive action. We had to protect ourselves. There is a road that runs between our two countries. It is small by your standards, not even paved in most places. But it was the main southern artery in Balochistan. To cut it at just one place, the Kerch River Bridge would have effectively sealed 60% of all refugee traffic. I flew the mission myself, at night with a heavy escort. You didn't need image intensifiers. You could see the headlights from miles away, a long, thin, white trail in the darkness. I could even see small arms gun flashes. The area was heavily infested. I targeted the bridge's center foundation, which would be the hardest part to repair. The bombs separated cleanly. They were high-explosive, conventional ordnance, just enough to do the job, nothing more. American aircraft from when we used to be your allies of convenience used to destroy a bridge built with American aid for the same purpose. The irony was not lost on the high command. Personally, I could have cared less. As soon as I felt my phantom lighten, I hit my burners, waited for my observer plane's report, and prayed with all my might that the Pakistanis wouldn't retaliate. Of course, my prayers went unanswered. 3 hours later, their garrison at Kila Safed shot up our border station. I know now that our president and Ayatollah were willing to stand down. We'd gotten what we wanted. They'd gotten their revenge. Tit for tat. Let it go. But who was going to tell the other side? Their embassy in Tehran had destroyed its codes and radios. That son of a bitching colonel had shot himself rather than betray any state secrets. We had no hotline, no diplomatic channels. We didn't know how to contact the Pakistani leadership. We didn't even know if there was any leadership left. It was such a mess. Confusion turning to anger. Anger turning on our neighbors. Every hour the conflict escalated. Border clashes, airstrikes. It happened so fast. Just 3 days of conventional warfare. Neither side having any clear objective. Just panicked rage. We created a beast. A nuclear monster with neither side having any idea how to tame it. Tehran, Islamabad, Qom, Lahore, Bandar Abbas, Ormara, Imam Khomeini, Faisalabad. No one knows how many died in the blasts or would die when the radiation clouds began to spread over our countries. Over India, Southeast Asia, the Pacific, over America. No one thought it could happen. Not between us. For God's sake, they helped us build our nuclear program from the ground up. They supplied the materials, the technology, the third-party brokering with North Korea and Russian renegades. We wouldn't have been a nuclear power if it wasn't for our fraternal Muslim brothers. No one would have expected it. But then again, no one would have expected the debt to rise, now would they? Only one could have foreseen this, and I don't believe in him anymore.
Denver, Colorado, USA. My train is late. The Western Drawbridge is being tested. Todd Wainio doesn't seem to mind waiting for me at the platform. We shake hands under the station's mural of victory, easily the most recognizable image of the American experience in World War Z. Originally taken from a photograph, it depicts a squad of soldiers standing on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River, their backs turned to us as they watch dawn break over Manhattan. My host looks very small and frail next to these towering, two-dimensional icons. Like most of his generation, Todd Wainio was old before his time. With an expanding paunch, receding, graying hair, and 3 deep, parallel scars down the side of his right cheek, it would be difficult to guess that this former U.S. Army infantryman is still, at least chronologically, at the beginning of his life.
The sky was red that day. All the smoke, the crap that had been filling the air all summer, it put everything in this amber-red light, like looking at the world through hell-colored glasses. That's how I first saw Yonkers, this little depressed, rust-collar burb just north of New York City. I don't think anybody had ever heard of it. I sure as hell hadn't. And now it's up there with, like, Pearl Harbor. No, not Pearl. That was a surprise attack. This was more like Little Bighorn, where we... Well, at least the people in charge, they knew what was up, or they should have. The point is, it wasn't a surprise. The war, or emergency, or whatever you want to call it was already on. It had been, what, 3 months since everyone jumped on the panic train? You remember what it was like, people just freaking out, boarding up their houses, stealing food, guns, shooting everything that moved. They probably killed more people, the Rambos and the runaway fires and the traffic accidents and just the whole shitstorm that we now call the Great Panic. I think that killed more people at first than Zack. I guess I can see why the powers that be thought that one big stand-up battle was such a good idea. They wanted to show the people that they were still in charge, get them to calm the hell down so they could deal with the real problem. I get it. And because they needed a propaganda smackdown, I ended up in Yonkers. It wasn't the worst place to make a stand. Part of the town sat right in this little valley, and right over the West Hills you had the Hudson River. The Sawmill River Parkway ran right through the center of our main line of defense, and the refugees streaming down the freeway were leading the dead right to us. It was a natural choke point, and it was a good idea. The only good idea that day.
Todd reaches for another Q, the homegrown American variety cigarette so named for its one-quarter tobacco content.
Why didn't they put us on the roofs? They had a shopping center, a couple of garages, big buildings with nice flat tops. They could have put a whole company right above the A&P. We could have seen the whole valley, and we could have been completely safe from the attack. There was this apartment building, about 20 stories, I think. Each floor had a commanding view of the freeway. Why wasn't there a rifle team in each window? You know where they put us? Right down on the ground, right behind sandbags or in fighting holes. We wasted so much time, so much energy preparing these elaborate firing positions. Good cover and concealment, they told us. Cover and concealment? Cover means physical protection, conventional protection from small arms and artillery or airdropped ordnance. That sound like the enemy we were about to go up against? Was Zack now calling in airstrikes and fire missions? And why the hell were we worried about concealment when the whole point of the battle was to get Zack to come directly at us? So back-asswards, all of it. I'm sure whoever was in charge must have been one of the last of the Fulda fucktards. You know, those generals who spend their nardrop years training to defend West Germany from Ivan. Tight-ass, narrow-minded, probably pissed off from so many years of brushfire war. He must have been an FF, because everything we did freaking stunk of Cold War static defense. You know they even tried to dig fighting holes for the tanks? The engineers blasted them right out of the A&P parking lot.
You had tanks?
Dude, we had everything. Tanks, Bradleys, Humvees armed with everything from 50 cals to these new Vasilik heavy mortars. At least those might have been useful. We had Avenger Humvee-mounted Stinger surface-to-air missile sets. We had this AVLB portable bridge layer system, perfect for the 3-inch deep creek that ran by the freeway. We had a bunch of XM electronic warfare vehicles, all crammed with radar and jamming gear and... Oh yeah, we even had a whole FOL, family of latrines, just plop right there in the middle of everything. Why? When the water pressure was still on and the toilets were still flushing in every building and house in the neighborhood. So much we didn't need. So much shit that only blocked traffic and looked pretty. And that's what I think they were really there for, just to look pretty.
For the press.
Hell yeah. There must have been at least one reporter for every two or three uniforms. On foot and in vans, I don't know how many news choppers must have been circling. You'd think with so many, they'd spare a few to try and rescue people from Manhattan. Hell yeah, I think it was all for the press. Show them our big green kill power. Or tan. Some were just back from the desert. They hadn't even been repainted yet. So much of it was for show. Not just the vehicles, but us as well. They had us in MOPP, dude. Mission-oriented protective posture. Big bulky suits and masks that are supposed to protect you from a radioactive or biochem environment.
Could your superiors have believed the undead virus was airborne?
If that's true, why didn't they protect the reporters? Why didn't our superiors wear them, or anyone else immediately behind the line? They were cool and comfortable in their BDUs while we sweated under layers of rubber, charcoal, and thick, heavy body armor. And what genius thought to put us in body armor anyway? Because the press reamed them for not having enough in the last war? Why the hell do you need a helmet when you're fighting a living corpse? Shit, they're the ones that need helmets, not us. And then you get the net rigs, the Land Warrior Combat Integration System. It was this whole personal electronic suite that allowed each one of us to link up with each other and the higher-ups to link up with us. Through your eyepiece, you could download maps, GPS data, real-time satellite recon. You could find your exact position on a battlefield, your buddy's positions, the bad guys. You could actually look through the video camera on your weapon or anyone else's to see what's over a hedge or around a corner. Land Warrior allowed every soldier to have the information of an entire command post and let the command post control those soldiers as a single unit. Netrocentric. That's what I kept hearing from the officers in front of the cameras. Netrocentric and hyperwar. Cool terms, but they didn't mean shit when you're trying to dig a fighting hole with MOPP gear and body armor and Land Warrior and standard combat load and all of it on the hottest day in what was one of the hottest summers on record. I can't believe I was still standing when Zack began to show up. It was just a trickle at first. Ones and twos staggering between the abandoned cars that jammed the deserted freeway. At least the refugees had been evacuated. Okay, that was another thing they did right. Picking a choke point and clearing the civilians. Great job. Everything else? Zack started entering the first kill zone, the one designated for MLRS. I didn't hear the rockets launch. My hood muffled the noise, but I saw them streak towards the target. I saw them arch on their way down as their casings broke away to reveal all those little bomblets on plastic streamers. They're about the size of a hand grenade, anti-personnel with a limited anti-armor capacity. They scattered amongst the G's, detonating once they hit the road or an abandoned car. Their gas tanks went up in like little volcanoes, geysers of fire and debris that added to the steel rain. I gotta be honest, it was a rush. Dudes were cheering in their mics, me too, watching ghouls start to tumble. I'd say there were maybe 30, maybe 40 or 50 zombies spread out across this half-mile stretch of freeway. The opening bombardment took out at least three-quarters of them.
Only three-quarters? Todd finishes his cigarette in one long, angry drag. Immediately, he reaches for another.
Yep, and that's what should have made us worry right then and there. Steel rain hit each and every single one of them, shredded their insides. Organs and flesh were scattered all over the damn place, dropping from their bodies as they came toward us. But headshots, you're trying to destroy the brain, not the body. And as long as they got a working thinker and some mobility, some were still walking, others too thrashed to stand, were crawling. Yeah, we should have worried, but there wasn't time. The trickle was now turning into a stream. More G's, dozens now, thick among the burning cars. Funny thing about Zack, you always think he's going to be dressed in his Sunday best. That's how the media portrayed them, right? Especially in the beginning. G's in business suits and dresses, like a cross-section of everyday America, only dead. That's not what they look like at all. Most infected, the early infected, the ones who went in that first wave, they either died under treatment or at home in their own beds. Most were either in hospital gowns or pajamas and nightshirts. Some were in sweats or their undies or just naked, a lot of them completely buck bare. You could see their wounds, the dried marks on their body, the gouges that made you shiver even inside that sweltering gear. The second steel rain didn't have half the impact of the first. No more gas tanks to catch, and now the more tightly packed G's just happened to be shielding each other from a possible head wound. I wasn't scared. Not yet. Maybe my wood was gone, but I was pretty sure it'd be back when Zack entered the Artie's kill zone. Again, I couldn't hear the paladins too far back up the hill, but I sure heard and saw their shells land. These were standard HE-155s, a high-explosive core with a fragmentation case. They did even less damage than the MLRs.
Why is that?
No balloon effect, for one. When a bomb goes off close to you, it causes the liquid in your body to burst, literally like a freaking balloon. That doesn't happen with Zack, maybe because he carries less bodily fluid than us, or because that fluid's more like a gel, I don't know. But it didn't do shit, neither did the SNT effect.
What is SNT?
Sudden nerve trauma, I think that's what you call it. It's another effect of close-in high explosives. The trauma is so great sometimes that your organs, your brain, all of it just shuts down like God flicking your life switch. Something to do with electrical impulses or whatnot. I don't know. I'm not a fucking doctor.
But that didn't happen.
Not once. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like Zack just skipped through the barrage unscathed. We saw bodies blown to shit, tossed into the air, ripped to pieces, even complete heads, live heads with eyes and jaws still moving, popping sky high like freaking crystal corks. We were taking them down, no doubt, but not as many or as fast as we needed to. The stream was now like a river, a flood of bodies slouching, moaning, stepping over their mangled bros as they rolled slowly and steadily toward us like a slow-motion wave. The next kill zone was direct fire from the heavy arms, the tanks' main 120s and Bradleys with their chain guns and FOTT missiles. The Humvees also began to open up, mortars and missiles and the Mark 19, which are like machine guns but firing grenades. The Comanches came whining in at what felt like inches above our heads with chains and hellfires and hydro rocket pods. It was a fucking meat grinder, a wood chipper, organic matter clouding like sawdust above the horde. Nothing can survive this, I was thinking, and for a little while it looked like I was right, until the fire started to die.
Started to die?
Petering out, withering.
For a second he is silent, and then, angrily, his eyes refocus.
No one thought about it. No one. Don't pull my pud with stories about budget cuts and supply problems. The only thing in short supply was common fucking sense. Not one of those West Point War College metal-up-the-ass four-star fart bags said, hey, we got plenty of fancy weapons. We got enough shit for them to shoot. No one thought about how many rounds the artillery would need for sustained operation, how many rockets for the MLRs, how many canister shots. The tanks had these things called canister shots. Basically a giant shotgun shell. They fire these little tungsten balls. Not perfect, you know, wasting like 100 balls for every G, but fuck, dude, at least it was something. Each Abrams only had three out of a total loadout of 40. The rest were standard heat or sabot. Do you know what a silver bullet, an armor-piercing, depleted uranium dart is going to do to a group of walking corpses? Nothing. Do you know what it feels like to see a 60-something ton tank fire into a crowd with absolutely ass-all result? Three canister rounds! What about the flechettes? That's the weapon we always hear about these days, flechettes, these little steel spikes that turn any weapon into an instant scattergun. We talk about them like they're a new invention, but we had them as far back as, like, Korea. We had them for the Hydro rockets and the Mark 19s. Just imagine that. Just one 19 firing 350 rounds a minute, each round holding like 100 spikes. Maybe it wouldn't have turned the tide, but god damn it. The fire was dying, Zack was still coming, and the fear. Everyone was feeling it, in the orders from the squad leaders, in the actions of the men around me. That little voice in the back of your head that keeps squeaking, oh shit, oh shit. We were the last line of defense, the afterthought when it came to firepower. We were supposed to pick off the random lucky G who happened to slip through the giant bitch slap of our heavier stuff. Maybe one in three of us was expected to fire his weapon. One in every 10 was expected to score a kill. They came by the thousands, spilling out over the freeway guardrails, down the side streets, around the houses, through them. So many of them, their moans so loud they echoed right through our hoods. We flipped our safeties off, sighted our targets. The order came to fire. I was a saw gunner, a light machine gun that you're supposed to fire in short, controlled burst, about as long as it takes to say, die, motherfucker, die. The initial burst was too low. I caught one square in the chest. I watched him fly backward, hit the asphalt, then get right back up again as if nothing happened. Dude, when they get back up...
The cigarette has burned down to his fingers. He drops and crushes it without noticing.
I did my best to control my fire and my sphincter. Just go for the head, I kept telling myself. Keep it together, just go for the head. And all the time my saw's chattering, die, motherfucker, die. We could have stopped him, we should have. One guy with a rifle, that's all you need, right? Professional soldiers, trained marksmen, how could they get through? They still ask that. Critics and armchair patents who weren't there. You think it's that simple? You think after being trained to aim for the center mass your whole military career, you can suddenly make an expert headshot every time? You think in that straitjacket and suffocation hood it's easy to recharge a clip or clear a weapon jam?
You'd think after watching all the wonders of modern warfare fall flat on their high-tech hyper-ass, that after already living through 3 months of the Great Panic and watching everything you knew as reality be eaten alive by an enemy that wasn't even supposed to exist, that you're gonna keep a cool fucking head and a steady fucking trigger finger?
He stabs that finger at me.
Well, we did! We still managed to do our job and make Zack pay for every fucking inch. Maybe if we'd had more men, more ammo, maybe if we'd just been allowed to focus on our job.
His finger curls back into his fist.
Land warrior. High-tech, high-priced, high-profile, netro-fucking-centric land warrior. To see what was in front of our face was bad enough, but Spybird uplinks were also showing how truly large the Horde was. We might be facing thousands, but behind them were millions. Remember, we were taking on the bulk of New York City's infestation. This was only the head of one really long undead snake stretching all the way back to Times fucking Square. We didn't need to see that. I didn't need to know that. That little scared voice wasn't so little anymore. Oh, shit. Oh, shit! And suddenly wasn't in my head anymore. It was in my earpiece. Every time some jerk-off couldn't control his mouth, Land Warrior made sure the rest of us heard it. There's too many! We gotta get the fuck out of here! Someone from another platoon, I didn't know his name, started hollering, I hit him in the head and he didn't die! They don't die when you shoot him in the head! I'm sure he must have missed the brain. It can happen. Around just grazing the inside of the skull, maybe if he'd been calm and used his own brain, he would have realized that. Panic's even more infectious than the Z-germ, and the wonders of Land Warrior allowed that germ to become airborne. What? They don't die? Who said that? You shot it in the head? Holy crap, they're indestructible! All over the net you could hear this, browning shorts across the info superhighway. Everyone pipe down, someone shouted. Hold the line, stay off the net, an older voice you could tell, but suddenly it was drowned out in this scream, and suddenly my eyepiece, and I'm sure everyone else's, was filled with the sight of blood spurting into a mouth of broken teeth. The sight was from a dude in the yard of a house behind the line. The owners must have left a few reanimated family members locked in when they bugged out. Maybe the shock from the explosions weakened the door or something, because they came bursting out right into this poor bastard. His gun camera recorded the whole thing, fell right at the perfect angle. There were five of them, a man, a woman, three kids. They had him pinned on his back. The man was on his chest. The kids had him by the arms, trying to bite through his suit. The woman tore his mask off. You could see the terror in his face. I'll never forget his shriek as she bit off his chin and lower lip. They're behind us, someone was shouting. They're coming out of the houses. The line's broken. They're everywhere. Suddenly the image went dark, cut off from an external source, and the voice, the older voice, was back again. Stay off the net, he ordered, trying real hard to control his voice, and then the link went dead. I'm sure it must have taken more than a few seconds. It had to, even if they'd just been hovering above our heads, but it seemed like right after the communications line blacked out that the sky was suddenly screaming with JSFs. I didn't see them release their ordnance. I was at the bottom of my hole cursing the army and God and my own hands for not digging deeper. That ground shook. The sky went dark. Debris was everywhere, earth and ash and burning whatever flying above my head. I felt this weight slam between my shoulder blades, soft and heavy. I rolled over. It was a head and torso, all charred black and still smoking and still trying to bite. I kicked it away and scrambled out of my hole seconds after the last of the J-Sows fell. I found myself staring into this cloud of black smoke. Where the Horde had been, the freeway, the houses, everything was covered by this midnight cloud. I vaguely remember other guys getting out of their holes, hatches opening on tanks and Bradleys, everyone just staring into the darkness. There was a quiet, a stillness that, in my mind, lasted for hours. And then they came, right out of the smoke like a freaking little kid's nightmare. Some were steaming, some were even still burning. Some were walking, some were crawling, some just dragging themselves along on their torn bellies. Maybe 1 in 20 was still able to move, which left, shit, a couple thousand? And behind them, mixing with their ranks and pushing steadily towards us, the remaining million that the airstrike hadn't even touched. And that's when the line collapsed. I don't remember it all at once. I see these flashes, people running, grunts, reporters. I remember a newsman with a big Yosemite Sam mustache trying to pull a Beretta from his vest before three burning G's pulled him down. I remember a dude forcing open the door of a news van, jumping in, throwing out a pretty blonde reporter, and trying to drive away before a tank crushed them both. Two news choppers crashed together, showering us with their own steel rain. One Comanche driver, brave, beautiful motherfucker, tried to turn his rotor onto the oncoming G's. The blade diced a path right down their mast before catching on a car and hurling him into the A&P. Shooting. Crazy random shooting. I took a round in the sternum, in my armor's center plate. I felt like I'd run into a wall, even though I'd been standing still. It knocked me on my ass. I couldn't breathe. And just then some dumbass lobbed a flashbang right in front of me. The world was white. My ears were ringing. I froze. Hands were clawing me, grabbing my arms. I kicked and punched. I felt my crotch get warm and wet. I shouted, but I couldn't even hear my own voice. More hands, stronger, were trying to haul me somewhere. Kicking, squirming, cursing, crying. Suddenly a fist clocked me in the jaw. It didn't knock me out, but I was suddenly relaxed. These were my buddies. Zach, don't punch. They dragged me into the closest Bradley. My vision cleared just long enough to see the line of light vanish with the closing hatch.
He reaches for another cue, then, abruptly, decides against it.
I know professional historians like to talk about how Yonkers represented a catastrophic failure of the modern military apparatus, how it proved the old adage that armies perfect the art of fighting the last war just in time for the next one. Personally, I think that's a big old sack of it. Sure, we were unprepared. Our tools, our training, everything I just talked about, all one class A gold standard clusterfuck. But the weapon that really failed wasn't something that rolled off an assembly line. It's as old as, I don't know, I guess as old as war. It's fear, dude. Just fear. And you don't have to be Sun Freakin' Sue to know that the real fighting isn't about killing or even hurting the other guy. It's about scaring him enough to call it a day. Break their spirit. That's what every successful army goes for. From tribal face paint to the Blitzkrieg to, what do we call the first round of Gulf War II? Shock and awe? Perfect name. Shock and awe. But what if the enemy can't be shocked and awed? Not just won't, but biologically can't. That's what happened that day outside New York City. That's the failure that almost lost us the whole damn war. The fact that we couldn't shock and awe Zach boomeranged right back in our faces and actually allowed Zach to shock and awe us. They're not afraid. No matter what we do, no matter how many we kill, they will never, ever be afraid. Yonkers was supposed to be the day we restored confidence to the American people. Instead, we practically told them to kiss their ass goodbye. If it weren't for the Southrican plan, I have no doubt we'd all be slouching and moaning right now. The last thing I remember was the Bradley being tossed like a Hot Wheels car. I don't know where the hit was, but I'm guessing it must have been close. I'm sure had I still been standing out there exposed, I wouldn't be standing here today. Have you ever seen the effects of a thermobaric weapon? Have you ever asked anyone with stars on their shoulders about them? I bet my ballsack you'll never get the full story. You'll hear about the heat and pressure, the fireball that continues expanding, exploding, and literally crushing and burning everything in its path. Heat and pressure, that's what thermobaric means. Sounds nasty enough, right? What you won't hear about is the immediate after effect, the vacuum created when that fireball suddenly contracts. Anyone left alive will either have the air sucked right out of their lungs, or, and they'll never admit this to anyone, have their lungs ripped right out of their mouth. Obviously, no one's going to live long enough to tell that kind of horror story. Probably why the Pentagon's been so good at covering up the truth. But if you ever see a picture of a G, or even an example of a real walking specimen, and he's got both airbags and windpipe just dangling out from his lips, make sure you give him my number. I'm always up for meeting another veteran of Yonkers.
Part 4.
Turning the Tide. Robben Island, Cape Town Province, United States of Southern Africa. Kolelwa Azania greets me at his writing desk, inviting me to switch places with him so I can enjoy the cool ocean breeze from his window. He apologizes for the mess and insists on clearing the notes off his desk before we continue. Mr. Azania is halfway through his third volume of Rainbow Fist, South Africa at War, This volume happens to be about the subject we are discussing. The turning point against the living dead. The moment when his country pulled itself back from the brink.
Dispassionate. A rather mundane word to describe one of history's most controversial figures. Some revere him as a savior, some revile him as a monster. But if you ever met Paul Redeker, ever discussed his views of the world and the problems, or more importantly, the solutions to the problems that plague the world, probably the one word that would always cling to your impression of the man is dispassionate. Paul always believed, well, perhaps not always, but at least in his adult life, that humanity's one fundamental flaw was emotion. He used to say that the heart should only exist to pump blood to the brain, that anything else was a waste of time and energy. His papers from university, all dealing with alternate solutions to historical and societal quandaries, were what first brought him to the attention of the apartheid government. Many psychobiographers had tried to label him a racist. But in his own words, racism is a regrettable byproduct of irrational emotion. Others have argued that in order for a racist to hate one group, he must at least love another. Redeker believed both love and hate to be irrelevant. To him, they were impediments of the human condition. And, in his words again, imagine what could be accomplished if the human race would only shed its humanity. Evil. Most would call it that. While others, particularly that small cadre in the center of Pretoria's power, believed it to be an invaluable source of liberated intellect. It was the early 1980s. A critical time for the apartheid government. The country was resting on a bed of nails. You had the ANC, you had the Inkatha Freedom Party, you even had the extremist right-wing elements of the Afrikaner population that would have liked nothing better than open revolt in order to bring about a complete racial showdown. On her border, South Africa faced nothing but hostile nations. And, in the case of Angola, a Soviet-backed Cuban spearheaded civil war. Add to this mixture a growing isolation from the Western democracies, which included a critical arms embargo. And it was no surprise that a last-ditch fight for survival was never far from Pretoria's mind. This is why they enlisted the aid of Mr. Redeker to revise the government's ultra-secret Plan Orange. Orange had been in existence since the apartheid government first came to power in 1948. It was the doomsday scenario for the country's white minority, the plan to deal with an all-out uprising of its indigenous African population. Over the years, it had been updated with the changing strategic outlook of the region. Every decade, that situation grew more and more grim. With multiplying independence of her neighbor states and multiplying voices for freedom from the majority of her own people, those in Pretoria realized that a full-blown confrontation might not just mean the end of the Afrikaner government, but the Afrikaners themselves. This is where Redeker stepped in. His revised Plan Orange, appropriately completed in 1984, was the ultimate survival strategy for the Afrikaner people. No variable was ignored. Population figures, terrain, resources, logistics. Redeker not only updated the plan to include both Cuba's chemical weapons and his own country's nuclear option, but also, and this is what made Orange 84 so historic, the determination of which Afrikaners would be saved and which had to be sacrificed.
Sacrificed?
Redeker believed that to try and protect everyone would stretch the government's resources to the breaking point, thus dooming the entire population. He compared it to survivors from a sinking ship capsizing a lifeboat that simply did not have room for them all. Redeker had even gone so far as to calculate who should be brought aboard. He included income, IQ, fertility, an entire checklist of desirable qualities, including the subject's location to a potential crisis zone.
The first casualty of the conflict must be our own sentimentality,
was the closing statement for his proposal.
For its survival will mean our destruction.
Orange 84 was a brilliant plan. It was clear, logical, efficient, and it made Paul Redeka one of the most hated men in South Africa.
His first enemies were some of the more radical, fundamentalist Afrikaners, the racial ideologues, and the ultra-religious. Later, after the fall of apartheid, his name began circulating among the general population. Of course, he was invited to appear before the Truth and Reconciliation hearings, and of course, he refused.
"I won't pretend to have a heart simply to save my skin," he stated publicly, adding,
"No matter what I do, I am sure they will come for me anyway."
And they did, although it probably was not in the manner Redeka could have expected.
It was during our great panic, which began several weeks before yours. Redeka was holed up in the Drakensberg cabin he had bought with the accumulated profits of a business consultant. He liked business, you know, one goal, no soul, he used to say. He wasn't surprised when the door blew off its hinges and agents of the National Intelligence Agency rushed in. They confirmed his name, his identity, his past actions. They asked him point blank if he had been the author of Orange 84. He answered, without emotion, naturally. He suspected and accepted this intrusion as a last-minute revenge killing. The world was going to hell anyway. Why not take a few apartheid devils down first? What he could never have predicted was the sudden lowering of their firearms and the removal of the gas masks of the NIA agents. They were of all colors, black, Asian, colored, and even a white man, a tall Afrikaner who stepped forward and, without identifying his name or rank, asked abruptly, "You've got a plan for this, man, don't you?" Redeka had indeed been working on his own solution to the undead epidemic. What else could he do in this isolated hideaway? It had been an intellectual exercise. He never believed anyone would be left to read it. It had no name, as explained later, because names only exist to distinguish one from others, and until that moment, there had been no other plan like his. Once again, Redeka had taken everything into account. Not only the strategic situation of the country, but also the physiology, behavior, and combat doctrine of the living dead. While you can research the details of the Redeka plan in any public library around the world, here are some of the fundamental keys. First of all, there was no way to save everyone. The outbreak was too far gone. The armed forces had already been too badly weakened to effectively isolate the threat, and spread so thinly throughout the country they could only grow weaker with each passing day. Our forces had to be consolidated, withdrawn to a special safe zone, which hopefully would be aided by some natural obstacles such as mountains, rivers, or even an offshore island. Once concentrated within this zone, the armed forces could eradicate the infestation within its borders, then use what resources were available to defend it against further onslaughts of the living dead. That was the first part of the plan. And it made as much sense as any conventional military retreat. The second part of the plan dealt with the evacuation of civilians, and this could not have been envisioned by anyone else but Redeka. In his mind, only a small fraction of the civilian population could be evacuated to the safe zone. These people would be saved not only to provide a labor pool for the eventual wartime economic restoration, but also to preserve the legitimacy and stability of the government, to prove to those already within the zone that their leaders were looking out
for them.
There was another reason for this partial evacuation. An eminently logical and insidiously dark reason that many believe will forever ensure Redeka the tallest pedestal in the pantheon of hell. Those who were left behind were to be herded into special isolated zones. They were to be human bait, distracting the undead from following the retreating army to their safe zone. Redeka argued that these isolated, uninfected refugees must be kept alive, well defended and even resupplied if possible, so as to keep the undead hordes firmly rooted to the spot. You see the genius, the sickness, keeping people as prisoners because every zombie besieging those survivors will be one less zombie throwing itself against our defenses. That was the moment when the Afrikaner agent looked up at Redeka and crossed himself. God help you, man, he said.
God help us all, said
one of the other agents, a black one who appeared to be in charge of the operation. Now let's get him out of here. Within minutes, they were on a chopper for Kimberley, the very underground base where Redeka had first written Orange 84. He was ushered into a meeting of the president's surviving cabinet, where his report was read aloud to the room. You should have heard the uproar, with no voice louder than the defense minister's.
Unacceptable!
He bellowed. He was a Zulu, a ferocious man who would rather be fighting in the streets than cowering in a bunker.
Running, hiding, cowering behind mountains, never!
He was not alone.
How can we explain this to our people?
Said the vice president.
They'll be after our backsides faster than those things out there.
The president was incensed, glaring at the safety security minister in command of the NIA.
This is what you bring me,
he snapped. The maniacal ramblings of an apartheid war criminal.
Mr. President, said the clearly rattled security minister, you instructed me to find and retrieve Mr. Redeka.
I did no such thing,
the president shot back.
But Mr. President, the security minister stammered, I received an order.
Not from me,
bellowed the president.
From me. That was another voice. A soft, quiet voice that silenced the room like thunder from God himself.
He had been sitting against the back wall. Now he stood, hunched over by age, and supported by canes, but with a spirit as strong and vital as it had ever been. The elder statesman, the father of our new democracy, the man whose birth name had been Rolihlahla, which some have translated simply into troublemaker. As he stood, all others sat, all others except poor Redeka. The old man locked eyes on him, smiled with that warm squint so famous the world over, and said, Molo Nlobo Wam, greetings, person of my region. He walked slowly over to Paul, turned to the governing body of South Africa, then lifted the pages from the Afrikaner's hand and said in a suddenly loud and youthful voice,
this plan will save our people.
Then gesturing to Paul, he said,
this man will save our people.
And then came that moment, the one that historians will probably debate until the subject fades from memory. He embraced the white Afrikaner. To anyone else, this was simply his signature bear hug, but to Paul Redeka, I know that the majority of psychobiographers continue to paint this man without a soul. That is the generally accepted notion. Paul Redeka, no feelings, no compassion, no heart. However, one of our most revered authors, Biko's old friend and biographer, postulates that Redeka was actually a deeply sensitive man. Too sensitive, in fact, for life in apartheid South Africa. He insists that Redeka's lifelong jihad against emotion was the only way to protect his sanity from the hatred and brutality he witnessed on a daily basis. Not much is known about Redeka's childhood, whether he even had parents, or was raised by the state, whether he had friends or was ever loved in any way. Those who knew him from work were hard-pressed to remember witnessing any social interaction or even any physical act of warmth. The embrace by our nation's father, this genuine emotion, piercing his impenetrable shell.
Azania smiles sheepishly.
Perhaps this is all too sentimental. For all we know, he was a heartless monster. And the old man's embrace had absolutely no impact.